much more to be grateful that I'm not preaching on what the gospel is all. Because when I started to write that, it was just too convoluted for me to understand. So I put that aside, but also a play on my time to see my father last week in Florida. I started reading a book that led me to find another beginning place into these lessons. So a better title would be The Kind of People We Want to Become. And a better text would be Take Care and Watch Yourselves Closely. So as we read, you forget the things that your eyes have seen, or let them slip from your mind all the days of your life. In her latest novel, Clock Dance, Anne Tyler begins with a personal note. I believe, she writes, that our entire lives can be shaped by a single decision that we make during childhood as to who exactly we should be, as to how we should be, what kind of people we want to become. At age 7, Tyler arrived at a single life-shaping decision after 6 years of studying her short-tempered and erratic but very bright mother and her steady, patient, gentle father. At age 7, she made up her mind to be the steady one. Then she says, I turned 8 and never had another significant insight in my life. I found myself thinking this week about what leads us to make a decision early on in life, or maybe not so early on, concerning the kinds of persons we want to become. I thought about this as I read and reread the tense new change that begins Mark's 7th chapter. In the company of the confident Pharisees, the clueless disciples, and a contentious Jesus, I heard Mark inviting us to decide today who and how we should be the people we want to be and become as followers of Jesus Christ and members of his church. And when Israel was deciding who and how to be God's people, it began with the commandments given to Moses at Sinai by the God who had brought them out of Egypt. According to Walter Brueggemann, the intent of the commandments is to institutionalize the Exodus by establishing a people, shaping a people, whose perspectives, procedures, policies, and institutions will practice God's justice and not Pharaoh's injustice. Practice neighborly well-being instead of coercion, fear, and exploitation. Significantly for where we are headed this morning, the Exodus was not a one-time rescue. It required a decision to live in a particular way with one another under God's rule that had to be remembered and reenacted moment by moment and Sabbath by Sabbath. Because God is a God who is forever delivering human beings from bondage, it is God's ongoing deliverance that is the intent of the commandments. Yet in living under God's rule moment by moment and Sabbath by Sabbath, Israel came to believe that there was no circumstance in which God did not will something concrete. So clearly more than 10 commandments would be needed to help them be the people they wanted to become. In response, two distinct codes of interpretive commands were added. Codes that addressed the changing context of Israel's life, and codes was the threat that the Holy God would withdraw from a people who themselves were not pure and holy. You can trace the purity code forward to the Pharisees. Then to a theologian named Arius in the 4th century who believed the church to be a gathering of the morally perfectible, purifiable, rather than a hospital for sinners. And on today, whenever you see a bunch of Christians leaving one congregation to form a more pure congregation. Being God's people in the world. The second set of interpretive commands involved distinct practices of social justice required by God of God's people that contrast Israel's Exodus ethic to the surrounding Canaanite way. The Sabbath command was central and decreed practices of rest, such as debts canceled every 7th year, so that there would be no permanent underclass, a jubilee year every 50th, in which family land lost in the give and take of business is returned. Provisions for runaway slaves, for refusal to charge interest to Israelites, for protection against the seizure of a poor person's property as equity for a loan, for prompt payment of wages to the poor, for care of the socially marginalized. It is clear, Rubin concludes, that this interpretive tradition of commands intends that social power must be in the service of justice, God's justice. According to Mark, you can trace this interpretive tradition of justice forward to Jesus. But by the time Mark wrote his gospel, the Jerusalem religious establishment had also created an additional oral tradition known as the tradition of the elders that further interpreted not the social justice code, but the purity code. When the Pharisees noticed Jesus eating with defiled hands, Jesus' disciples eating with defiled hands, they asked Jesus why his disciples are not living according to the tradition of the elders. Mark reminds his readers that this tradition required the Pharisees to wash their hands thoroughly before they ate, to wash everything from the market, to wash cups and pots and wrong kettles and more. Reasonable practices, we would say. But what's not evident in Mark's text is the way the tradition of the elders functioned to benefit the Judean elites who made up about 5% of the Jewish population. According to Presbyterian preacher Stephen McClellan, the elites lived in towns and cities and had access, time, and money for the water needed to follow the Pharisaic interpretation of what constituted cleanliness. More than 95% of the population did not have easy access, time, or money to water. Were commonly referred to by the Pharisees as the Amharites, which means the dirty people of the land. Essentially, the Pharisees are asking Jesus, why his disciples, are acting like the very people of the land, people with whom the Christians can have nothing to do if they are to maintain their purity for the sake of their relationship with the Holy God. Jesus is asking the Pharisees why they have chosen the injustice of their purity ethic over the justice of the Exodus ethic. Is using the story to ask his community then and ask us now to discover what kind of people we want to become as followers of Jesus Christ. To see Jesus through the lens of the interpretive code of purity or through the lens of the interpretive code of social justice is to rejoice, as throughout the Gospels, Jesus is touched by the woman with an issue of blood, and as he touches the lepers to heal them. It is to chastise or cheer him as he speaks with the Samaritan woman at the well, or eats with tax collectors and sinners. It is to revile or revere him as he takes on the religious establishment and brings good news to the dirty people of the land. Yet it is easy to rejoice and cheer and revere him from the distance of his redeeming love for characters who lived 2,000 years ago. It's obvious. People with dirty hands today? The answer is far in these parts and times such as these. Though if you do not at least include the parents and children separated at our borders, then I do not know who you are becoming. But equally daunting is the realization that to decide to be and become the person whose life of God is defined by purity is necessarily to reject being and becoming the person whose faith finds you dining with dirty hands among people with dirty hands. I thought about this. About the decision we make early on, or maybe not so early on in life concerning the people we want to become. Not only as I read and reread these lessons, but as I watched the service for John McCain at the National Cathedral yesterday morning. And particularly as McCain's favorite character in Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls was invoked in one of the eulogies. Not with the words McCain himself had borrowed as he said farewell to the nation. Contrary to many others, believe that our entire lives can be shaped by a single decision made when we were 7 as to what kind of person we want to become. Hemingway's Robert Jordan echoed the daily decision required by the Exodus ethic. He said, "Today is only one day in all the days that will ever be. But what will happen in all the other days that ever come can depend on what you do today." In the context of Mark's gospel, I take that to mean the discipleship is not a one-time decision, but requires us to decide today to live in a particular way with one another under God's rule. It is a decision that has to be remembered and reenacted moment by moment, Sunday by Sunday, until the day we die. On this Sunday, the invitation is Jesus' invitation rather than ours. He invites each one of us to come to this table with dirty hands. Invites us to dine among with us from the beginning, and him who breathed his hands